Deadline's Press TV denounces the U.S. for seizing its website and other Iranian and regional news networks, calling it a terrorist attack on global public opinion. Media reports say four members of the death squad that murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi had been trained in the United States. And Beijing calls the U.S. the greatest creator of risks for regional security after an American warship sailed through a waterway that separates Taiwan from China. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, Press TV strongly condemned the U.S. government's seizure of its website, calling the move a violation of international law. In a statement, Press TV also called the U.S. action a terrorist attack on the world's public opinion, adding that the decision was an example of the media dictatorship. Tehran-based International News Network announced that the viewers can now access its website through the .ir domain. Earlier, the U.S. government confiscated 36 websites belonging to Iranian and regional news outlets, including Press TV, viewers trying to access these websites. See a message showing the domains are seized by the U.S. government. It also cites U.S. sanctions laws for the seizure of the websites of Iran's Al-Olam and Yemen's Al-Masira TV channel are among the outlets targeted. Iran's Minister of Information and Communications Technology has slammed the United States for confiscating dozens of Iranian and regional news websites.
The move shows that the resistance front enjoys wide-spanning influence because the U.S. government has breached the values it claims to be upholding. The U.S. action is not the first of its kind. During the past 3 or 4 years, many measures have been taken to hinder Iran's speedy progress in the virtual space, from removing Iranian apps in violation of international laws to imposing sanctions on Iranian firms to prevent them from accessing software distribution platforms.
Azadi Jahromi noted that Washington's move shows its desperation in the face of resistance. Earlier, President Hassan Rouhani's chief of staff said Washington's measure was against freedom of speech. Mahmoud Boazi added that the U.S. blocked the sites to prevent the reflection of different viewpoints online. Boazi said Iran will use all legal and international means to follow up on the case. He also denounced Washington's move as unconstructive for the ongoing talks on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal. Press TV has been monitoring social media platforms to see people's reaction to the U.S. government's seizure of multiple websites belonging to Iranian and regional news outlets. Let's see what they had to say on the matter.
The U.S. has seized multiple news websites associated with other countries. This sets a horrifying precedent in which the U.S. shuts down the flow of information, except for U.S.-approved propaganda.
U.S. democracy in action. Censoring Iranian journalism. Does it bother EU High Representative Joseph Borrell or the European Parliament that they unconditionally support the U.S., who are found by the Alliance of Democracies Foundation to be the world's biggest threat to democracy?
Between shutting down Iran's media websites and a few weeks stealing and selling off $100 million of its crude oil, it is clear that the Biden regime will take what they want from Iran by force. These are not actions of good faith negotiators.
I think highly of Iran and agree that the U.S. regime is authoritarian. Seizing Iranian and pro-resistance websites exposes the U.S. as opposing freedom and again proves that the U.S. weaponizes the internet. Western media and elites don't condemn this because they support silencing dissent.
Washington is currently stealing and blocking many Iranian websites.
If the U.S. government is trying to silence you, you're probably doing something right. It's still extremely egregious and an affront on the press, but I'm going to take it as a badge of honor.
How is this possible, and what precedents are set?
One reason why the U.S. regime just seized Press TV's website. Press TV seems to be the only English-language international network giving heavy attention to global protests and action against Israel's assault on Gaza, from New York City to Rome to Islamabad, and giving protesters extended time to express themselves.
Security sources in Iran say the country has foiled a sabotage attempt on one of the buildings of its atomic energy organization. The sources said the attempt took place in the early hours of Wednesday. They said the attempt was foiled before causing any casualties or damage. No further details are available for now. The same sources said an investigation has been launched into the incident. Iran's president-elect, Ebrahim Raisi, spoke with reporters following his win in the last week election to a question that whether he's willing to meet the U.S. President Joe Biden. Raisi said no. The president-elect also spoke about his views on the 2015 Iran nuclear deal as well as the country's regional policies. And one thing was certain, his foreign policy agenda would neither start nor end with the nuclear agreement.
Iran's president-elect Said Ebrahim Raisi has held his first press briefing in the capital, Tehran. The event, attended by representatives of domestic and foreign media outlets, was Raisi's first briefing following his election as Iran's next president. During the media conference, Raisi touched on a number of issues, including the fate of the landmark nuclear deal with Iran. Officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Raisi said the U.S. must return to full compliance with the 2015 deal. "We tell the United States that you have to remove all sanctions imposed on Iran and must return to the nuclear deal and fulfill your obligations. Europeans must not be influenced by the U.S. pressure and must act upon their commitments. This is what the Iranian nation wants from you."
Iran President-elect Ebrahim Raisi said that the U.S. and Europe need to fulfill their commitments under the JCPOA, meaning that he sees this as a two-sided way and not one-sided. And this is something provisional, and he says that Iran will comply with the terms of the nuclear deal, provided that the other sides and parties do the same.
Raisi said the main focus of his administration's foreign policy will be to make sure about complete removal of unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. after Washington's illegal withdrawal from the nuclear deal with Tehran, followed by verification of sanctions removal. He also said Europeans must not be influenced by the U.S. pressure and must act upon their commitments. Raisi further ruled out the idea of meeting the U.S. President Joe Biden, saying the foreign policy of his administration will not start from the JCPOA, nor will it be restricted to the JCPOA.
One of the options he will be trying to seek during his term, I think, will be to follow a, let's say, trade-based foreign policy and approach. There is a potential and capacity to cooperate with neighboring countries or regional countries and eastern countries. So he will have this option as a tool in his foreign policy toolbox. And let's say, this policy, he will try to prove the Americans and Europeans that if they think that Iran cannot survive without the nuclear deal, they are wrong.
During his election campaign, Raisi explained about some of the policies that his future administration would adopt. They included foreign policy issues. Raisi spoke about an active diplomacy and said his administration would interact with the world. But he stressed it's illogical that the country's progress, including its economic development, is tied to foreign relations.
Asked about a proposal by U.S. President Joe Biden to sign a new deal with Iran to address the country's missile program and regional influence as well, Raisi said issues related to Iran's regional influence and missile program are not open to negotiation.
Iran's regional and missile programs are not negotiable. They have not fulfilled their commitments regarding issues that have already been negotiated and agreed upon. How can they enter into new discussions?
Raisi said the U.S. failed to observe its obligations under the nuclear deal, stressing that Washington is in no position to call on Iran for further negotiations on Iran's missile program and its regional influence. Raisi further stressed that he intends to develop constructive and balanced relations with all countries, particularly Iran's neighbors.
We have seen that Iran, as a result of U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal, as well as maximum pressure by the United States, moved toward more cooperation with other countries, including China, Russia, and its neighboring countries. This can be somehow more visible during a new conservative president in Tehran, meaning Ebrahim Raisi, if he takes office. I think, and if the Europeans and Americans do not fulfill their commitments under the nuclear deal, he will be moving toward more cooperation with non-Western countries.
Asked about the future outlook for Iran's relations with Saudi Arabia, Raisi said, from the viewpoint of Iran, there is no obstacle to the reopening of Iran's and Saudi Arabia's embassies. Raisi also touched on the issue of Saudi-led war in Yemen, saying that Iran stresses that the war against Yemen must come to a rapid halt and that Yemen must be run by Yemenis. He also said that Iran will continue to be a defender of the oppressed people, including the Palestinians, stressing that from the perspective of Iran, Palestinians are the owners of Palestine. Raisi suggested that a referendum is the best solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Elsewhere, four of the Saudi operatives who participated in the 2018 killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi had received military training in the U.S. That's what a leading American daily says. According to the New York Times, the U.S. State Department approved the training. It was provided by a private security company in the state of Arkansas. The firm had previously confirmed its role in the training of the several members of the Khashoggi kill team. The State Department says it cannot legally comment on what it has referred to as licensed defense export activities. Khashoggi was killed in the Turkish city of Istanbul on October the 2nd, 2018, after he entered the Saudi consulate there. U.S. intelligence reports have said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the murder. The Israeli regime continues its demolition drive in the occupied West Bank despite condemnations from Palestinians and the international community. Israeli bulldozers backed by forces raised to the ground two more homes in Al-Isawiya town east of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. Earlier in the day, Palestinian media reported the destruction of buildings near the outpost of Benyamin. Last week, Israeli forces also leveled a house in the town of Beit Omar. The demolitions are the latest in Israel's long-running campaign to flatten Palestinian homes and property. The structures are usually destroyed under the pretext of lacking construction permits. But Palestinians say the demolitions are part of efforts by Israel to expand its legal settlements in the occupied territories. Three Palestinian prisoners remain on hunger strike in an Israeli jail to protest their illegal detention without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention. One of the hunger strikers has been transferred to hospital, but he insists to continue his strike until Israel releases him. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Ghadanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal al-Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushra al-Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Well, China has accused the U.S. of creating trouble in the Taiwan Strait after an American warship sailed through the sensitive waterway that separates Taiwan from China. China said the U.S. is intentionally playing the same old tricks and disrupting things in the Taiwan Strait. Beijing described Washington as the greatest security risk creator in the region. The U.S. Navy has confirmed the transit. It said the Tuesday sailing was a routine mission in accordance with international law. The U.S. has stepped up such missions in the past months despite China's opposition. China considers Taiwan its own territory. It believes the American missions send a message of support to Taiwan that seeks independence. The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea, who visited South Korea, says that he would meet with North Korean representatives anytime, anywhere, and without preconditions. North Korea has ridiculed the U.S. overture, saying it would lead to nowhere but disappointment. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang. U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader thanks Iranians for their response to the Islamic Republic's call. This is part of a message issued on February 28, 2016, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, following the glorious presence of the people of Iran in parliamentary and the Assembly of Experts elections.
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I thank God, the Omniscient and the Almighty, for helping the knowledgeable and determined people of Iran achieve victory in another great test. For the 36th time since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, they showed their presence in a public election with firm willpower and with memorable enthusiasm and excitement to determine the fate of the country in the present era, to elect their representatives for the formation of two powerful and significant assemblies and to once more demonstrate religious democracy, which radiated from their shining and powerful faces to people all around the world. Islamic Iran feels proud of its people, and it feels honored because of the strength of the rules and regulations that provide these valuable opportunities for nationalizing and replenishment. I consider it my duty to thank the people for the public response to the Islamic Republic's call and to ask God to bestow his reward and guidance on the people who created this eventful and glorious Friday. I would like to remind the officials of the country whether the elected candidates for the Islamic Consultative Assembly and the Assembly of Experts, those who have executive positions in other branches or other officials in other organizations and associations, that they should fulfill the obligation to properly thank the people through rendering genuine services to them and to the country and the Islamic Republic. They should consider the following as their permanent plan in this term of responsibility: leading a simple and virtuous lifestyle, being constantly present for one's duty, preferring national interests to personal and partisan aspirations, standing up courageously in the face of foreign interferences, giving a revolutionary response to the plots of ill-wishers and traitors, adopting a jihadi outlook in thinking and in action, and to put it in one sentence, working for the sake of God and in the way of rendering services to God's creatures. They should not violate from these things at any price.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
back in June 2019, Iran shot down an intruding RQ-4A Global Hawk unmanned reconnaissance aircraft with surface-to-air missiles over the coastal province of Hormozgan. The high-tech spy drone belonged to the United States and had a price tag of over $120 million. Americans claimed that the drone was flying in international airspace when hit. However, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif dismissed the claim and later in the day announced that Iran had located parts of the drone in its territorial waters. The downing of the American spy drone sent a strong message to Washington. It signaled that Iran's deterrence power is way higher than Americans' expectation and that Iran will not be bullied by any country, even the U.S. Any intrusion on its soil and airspace will be met harshly. They are its red lines. The incident was not the first time a U.S. military spy drone was seized or shot down by Iran's air defense forces. There were several similar instances in the previous years. Washington, which found its image damaged by the incident, threatened Tehran with a military attack. However, knowing Iran's defensive capabilities, the U.S. refrained from an armed confrontation. Coincidentally, Iran experienced cyber attacks after that. The U.S. also imposed fresh anti-Iran sanctions against Tehran's move. Iran has always said that its military power is solely for defensive purposes and does not pose any threat to other countries. Nevertheless, Iran says it will not leave any act of aggression against its territory unanswered.
Well, my take on this was that the Americans were trying to provoke the Iranians into an intemperate, overly aggressive response. The Americans are trying to push the Iranians into a corner and force them to retaliate against an American provocation that would guarantee the United States would be able to say, see, look what the Iranians have done to us. We have to go in with horse, foot, and guns and teach them a lesson and end their aggressive ways. So I think that by making a temperate response, knocking down the drone, and then sitting back and waiting for the American reaction was an excellent example of a very cool, calculated response by the Iranian government. They would not be bullied, and they would not let themselves be pushed into a corner and making a mistake.
On January 3rd last year, top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike. 5 days later, Iran retaliated by firing dozens of missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base in Al-Anbar Governorate, western Iraq, declaring that the attacks were part of its promised tough revenge for the assassination. It also sent a message to Israel not to continue threatening Iran militarily. According to Pentagon, over 100 American soldiers suffered traumatic brain injuries as a result of the missile strike against Ain al-Assad. Since then, U.S. bases in Iraq have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Also, Washington has started to withdraw its anti-missile batteries from countries including Iraq, Kuwait, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. The move reflects recent changes on the ground in the West Asia region.
But as I was told, the Americans simply think that they can get away with it. So the Iranian response in Iraq after the murder of Lieutenant General Soleimani and the deputy director of the Popular Mobilization Units in Iraq was, again, a very temperate response. The Iranians told the Americans through the Iraqis that a response is coming, that rockets will be fired, and you better run for the hills. So I think that the Iranians have again proved that they will not be bullied, they will not be provoked, and it's the Americans who are the danger, the Americans who are constantly seeking an attempt to start a war against Iran.
The presence of U.S. forces in the West Asia region has increased instability. This is most notably seen in Iraq, then in Syria and Afghanistan. Yemen could be on that list too. After spending trillions of dollars in West Asia, the U.S. has nothing to show for it, something the former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted to. Iran's Judiciary Chief Seyed Ebrahim Raisi has won Iran's 2021 presidential election by a landslide. He managed to secure nearly 18 million of the votes and become the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. Some 29 million Iranians voted in Iran's 13th presidential election. Raisi won the presidential race amid an all-out political and media war led by the United States and its Western and regional allies targeting the event. The Islamic Republic's opponents attempted to portray a gloomy picture of the polls to discourage popular contribution. However, the Iranian people foiled the enemy's plots as the turnout was beyond their perceived low notion. Also, the public reception forced officials to extend the time limit on the election, with polls remaining open until past midnight. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, praised the epic turnout in Iran's 13th presidential election.
The leader said the high turnout neutralized the campaigns launched by the enemy's media outlets and ill-wishers to create voter apathy in the election. Ayatollah Khamenei said nothing could break the Iranian nation's will and disrupt the election. Meanwhile, the outgoing Iranian president Hassan Rouhani met president-elect Ebrahim Raisi in person to congratulate. The outgoing president stated his full support for his successor and stressed his willingness to offer assistance to the new government. In turn, president-elect Raisi pledged all-out efforts to resolve the country's problems, especially those affecting the people's livelihoods. Raisi noted that he would consult with the outgoing administration, parliament, and the elites to achieve the goal. Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi received congratulatory messages from several world leaders for winning Friday's presidential election, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, who expressed hope for further development of constructive cooperation between Moscow and Tehran. Raisi will take office in 45 days. He has promised to form a hard-working, anti-corruption and revolutionary cabinet and fight corruption and uproot poverty.
You know, we can say that the main and the only loser in this election was were those who actually were discouraging people from going to the ballot boxes and turn out to vote. And either if those politicians inside Iran or those dissident Iranians outside Iran, in some cases, who attacked actually the voters against the law. So they were the main losers because they were trying to discourage people to turn out, to say that people are not supporting the government, and that means that there is lack of legitimacy, and because of that, the government should not be respected and considered respected, actually, being recognized in, by other countries.
Sixty-year-old Ebrahim Raisi will take office in August. He is the eighth president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Raisi has promised to fight corruption and uproot poverty. He campaigned with the slogan, Popular Administration, Strong Iran, on a platform of uprooting corruption in the executive branch, fighting poverty and inflation, and creating jobs. President-elect Raisi is set to take power at a critical time as Iran seeks to salvage its tattered nuclear deal with major powers and free itself from illegal and inhumane U.S. sanctions that have driven a sharp economic downturn. Washington has been using sanctions as a weapon by preventing Iran from buying even its necessities and blocking the country's access to its overseas financial resources. Ebrahim Raisi had stated before that he would vigorously pursue efforts to get rid of sanctions imposed by the United States. He had said that his government would not allow the economy to be conditioned by the fate of sanctions removal talks, adding that Iranians want the economy to be stable.
You know, first, either the Americans leave the sanctions or not, Iran is going to diversify its basket of the diplomacy and defining policy and relations with other countries. So Iran has signed a memorandum of understanding for 25 years with China, is working on something similar to that with Russia and with some other countries. And it means that Iran is going to move forward and move on from the JCPOA and do not rely only on that. It's not the basket to put all the eggs on that.
President-elect Ebrahim Raisi has vowed to pursue sanctions removal efforts. He has noted that one should not deal abjectly with those who want to trample over the rights of the Iranian people. With him being the president, Washington is faced with a choice: remove all sanctions and return to compliance if it truly wants to save the nuclear deal, or follow the path of its past, confrontation and threats. Meanwhile, Iran has forged strong ties with both Russia and China and will proceed with its agenda with or without the U.S.
Relations between the United States and Russia came under the spotlight this week as presidents of the two geopolitical rivals sat down for talks in Geneva.
Before the meeting, Washington and Moscow had acknowledged that relations were at rock bottom. A series of tit-for-tat actions, which escalated in recent years, has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Moscow and Washington are at loggerheads over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. The depth of differences between the two sides had dashed hopes of any breakthrough during the meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The Geneva talks lasted around 3 hours. The two presidents did not even come close to resolving any of the acrimonious conflicts that have sent U.S.-Russian ties to their lowest level in decades. However, Biden and Putin agreed to launch a dialogue on atomic arms control. They also said that they would return ambassadors to Washington and Moscow to ease diplomatic contacts. The ambassadors were withdrawn in March for consultations after Washington accused Moscow of interference in America's 2020 presidential election. That is a claim that Moscow vehemently denies. The agreements in Geneva this week have somehow reduced bilateral tensions for now, but it is definitely too early to know whether the two rivals will eventually engage in meaningful cooperation. The presidents of the U.S. and Russia hailed their dialogue in Geneva. The Russian president said Biden was an experienced statesman. But despite the pleasantries, deep differences persisted in the meeting and after that. There was almost no sign of agreement on issues like cybersecurity and Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. Putin warned the U.S. against imposing new sanctions on Russia. Putin and Biden also clashed over human rights issues with the American leader, threatening devastating consequences for Moscow if Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who is now serving a 2.5-year sentence, died in jail.
As we know, Washington loves to throw human rights violation allegations against everyone, which is now extremely ironic because the current official president of the United States and many Democrats around him acknowledge that the Black Lives Matter movement has legitimate gripes with the United States. And the Black Lives Matter movement is a movement that claims that the United States grossly violates the human rights of its own citizens.
Putin dismissed U.S. concerns about Navalny, telling Biden that the opposition leader had ignored the law. The Russian president also criticized the status of human rights in America. Putin specifically named the Black Lives Matter movement and the January 6th attack on Capitol as two cases that show the U.S. has its own grave human rights-related problems. Observers believe it is too soon to judge the outcome of the Geneva meeting. Can the two rivals somehow build on their recent meeting, bridge their differences, and hammer out compromises in the future?
If you look back to the 1990s, after the triumph in the Cold War, the United States sat down, well, certain important elites sat down and wrote the Project for a New American Century. And one of the absolute and most key points of that project, to make the century completely American, is to not allow a new competitor to rise. And when you have this sort of zero-sum game, 0-1, win or lose sort of scenario, there's really no way to find any sort of true compromise or make any sort of friendly deal of any sort of meaning.
Bilateral talks on strategic arms limitations could start in a matter of weeks. The talks could serve as a test of the two sides' political will to engage in meaningful diplomacy and cooperation.
Iran's health minister, Saeed Namaki, announced on Monday that the Coviran Barakat coronavirus vaccine have received approval for public inoculations.
A legal commission gave approval to the Barakat vaccine for emergency use. The Barakat complex can now distribute the vaccines it's produced. God willing, the vaccine will be added to the national vaccination program starting next week.
He said that Iran had gone through nearly a year of intensive work to join the club of countries in the world with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus vaccines. Covirom Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and started to be mass-produced on March 29. It's been developed by Shifa Pharmid, a subsidiary of the Iranian economic and industrial conglomerate Zatar. The factory says its production capacity will reach 12 to 15 million doses per month in summer. Iran is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against the coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population.
The ability of Iran to develop its own vaccine is a step forward. It would have been a lot easier, I suspect, had there been no sanctions on some of the chemicals and other things needed to develop the vaccines. So I think we have to go back to these principles. If we are serious, if the United States is serious about moving forward to prevent the spread of this virus and to save lives, then there has to be an open-handed, generous, and honest relationship with Iran, with Cuba, with China and Russia and other makers of vaccines, including India and South Africa, all of which has been impeded by this emphasis on privatization and the maintenance of sanctions.
Iran hopes that domestic initiatives could significantly boost vaccine supplies for a nationwide inoculation program that started last year. The G7 summit in the United Kingdom ended with a pledge to distribute 1 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccine to the developing world, a figure that activists say is a drop in the bucket in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. In the meantime, some Western nations have been accused of hoarding the vaccines, even though their inoculation programs have lost their momentum. Others are also accusing them of engaging in vaccine diplomacy, taking advantage of vaccine donations to seek diplomatic favors, something that even the Western countries have acknowledged.
There's no doubt that some of this going about, and we don't support vaccine diplomacy, let alone blackmail. We think that we've got a moral duty, but also strong vested interest in getting the world vaccinated, because we know no one's safe until we're all safe.
The major pharmaceutical companies are yet to grant a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the production of their COVID-19 vaccines, a move that would facilitate poorer nations' access to the jabs. Meanwhile, nations like Iran and Cuba have joined forces to develop their vaccines to protect their population against the coronavirus pandemic.
From my point of view, I think it's great that Iran has been able to develop a vaccine working with the Cubans and the Russians and others. And this is an important step. And I think it's one reason why the United States began to say the other day, about 3 weeks ago now, well, maybe we should relax the patents and so on and so forth. But the whole system in the last 18 months reduced the speed and the efficacy of the distribution of the vaccine.
As major vaccine producers keep away the doses from the rest of the world, vaccines built by developing countries can be a beacon of hope for millions of people.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Deen al-Islam, deen al-Islam, deen al-Islam, Muhammad al-Hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. In this episode, we are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws of miscellaneous nature according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Halli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Halli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we know that for sure Islam has forbidden pigs and their meats. Everything is or related to the pigs and dogs are ritually impure.
Sure.
But you know that many people have to find a job and it's too difficult actually to do so, especially in the West. And if somebody has found a job, in fact, in a slaughterhouse, for example, in one of the Western stores or butchers or something like that, what is the Islamic law about working in such places where the pigs, in fact, are caught and sold?
Very good question. Well, As you rightly mentioned, pigs are ritually impure. The same is the case with dogs. They are impure. But, you know, pork is something that is commonly consumed in Western countries.
Yes.
And a lot of
dogs in some of the Asian countries.
Southeast Asian countries.
Especially black dogs, yeah.
Yes. And people have a lot to do with these things, especially in the West. They buy, they sell, they have stores, and they sell pork. And they also recruit Muslim workers and who, as you mentioned, do not find jobs. And they end up working in such places, of course. When it comes to, you know, working in a slaughterhouse, there's no problem, according to Ayatollah Sistani.
Mm-hmm.
The money that comes from the employer or who employs and who gives you the salary, of course, is halal, okay? Because you're not selling it. You're just slaughtering and things. You're maybe packing these things, okay? And also, if you're working in a store and you are you're supposed to actually carry pork from one place to another,
mm-hmm.
Still there is no objection to you. You can still keep working there. But when it comes to selling pork, of course, Islam does not allow a Muslim to sell pork as an obligatory precaution, because Ayatollah Sistani says that selling pork is not allowed as an obligatory precaution. And the same is the case with delivering pork, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Someone has paid, okay,
yes.
Bought a kilo of pork online, and you are going to deliver it, okay? And you are working in a delivery company. You are supposed to deliver a package of, pork to our client, to our customer. It's not permissible based on obligatory precaution. And we do know that wherever there's a precaution, the muqallid, the follower, has a choice to either act according to the precaution or move on or shift to another mujtahid, to the next most learned mujtahid who does not exercise precaution, who has a straightforward fatwa saying either it's haram or it's permissible.
Mm-hmm. Does the same rule apply, Sheikh Chawi, to having a job in a sandwich parlor? Sometimes sandwiches like hamburgers or stuff like that, you know, are with the ingredient of pork, such as bacon, for example,
sure,
in it. So what about those jobs?
It doesn't make any difference, you know, as long as you are selling pork and as long as it's considered to be selling pork, then the ruling is the same. You
mm-hmm.
are not you are not going to sell, and it's not permissible to sell pork.
They are not only selling pork. I mean,
yeah.
Like, they are selling other stuff, other sandwiches.
Sure, but...
including, for example, this particular sandwich,
mm-hmm.
which is somehow comprising...
Comprising
like a piece of, for example, pork.
You are right. Of course, when it comes to selling, halal sandwich,
mm-hmm.
okay, vegetable sandwiches made of vegetable or made of halal meat,
mm-hmm.
or made of things which are essentially halal
mm-hmm.
and pure, of course,
yes.
There's no objection to you. But, you know, to run a franchise of pork, because in some, for example, you're working in McDonald's, you know?
Yes.
And it has a part of French.
They have a vast variety,
variety of
sandwiches,
things,
all right,
yeah,
or eatable things, or edible things,
yes.
Right? Just part of their job description is to sell also, for example, that particular sandwich, which is like having or bearing a little bit of non-halal meat.
Of course, it's not permissible. And you should, because you are working for the company, and you can just tell them that you are not going to sell that, but you can sell other stuff,
uh-huh.
you know. Just like many people work in gas stations, you know.
Right.
People who work at gas stations are supposed to sell alcohol also,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there is no gas station in America or in Europe without let's say a small
convenience store.
Yeah, very good. Convenience store selling alcohol, you know. It's not permissible for a Muslim to sell alcohol, no matter what the situation or what the excuse, so on. But he can let someone else do it, okay? If he has a non-Muslim co-worker who's working with him, he should let that thing happen by him. And he cannot even receive the money for that, because if he receives it as a cashier, he's considered to be selling it, because a cashier is responsible for selling and receiving the money.
Yes.
So he cannot act even then as a cashier, and he should let someone else do it.
Mm-hmm. I see.
You know, but there's one thing I want to add to my point, and that is, if someone, you know, just sells these things, these items, with the intention of just getting rid of them and just giving up on these things, okay? Because these are things you have the right to give your hand up. You give up on these things, and you just receive the money with this intention that you are giving up on these haram items, okay?
Right.
Then in that case, the money that you receive is actually halal.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
I see.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
What about mahramiya? What does it mean, Sheikh Javi, to be a mahram or a non-mahram? Are there any specific rules? What are the necessary rules and laws about mahramiya?
Well, this is quite a different topic we are going to, because we are discussing miscellaneous issues. Of course, mahramiya is a long topic, and we can discuss it maybe in one of the following episodes. But even then, let me just say a few. Just say that mahram and non-mahram is a very important issue, especially in modern time, and when people are having interactions in the and different settings, like, for example, in the cyberspace, men and women have their interaction. In the external concrete world, of course, men and women have, and they